This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Lynn Mark. And today on The Breakfast Grill, I have with me Professor Syed Azam Ali, CEO of Crops for the Future. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you, Lynn. Delighted to be on.
So, with domestication and the advancement of agrarian technology, human beings are increasingly turning towards a limited number of food sources. This is something that's happening across the globe. And Crops for the Future, your mandate is to look into underutilized crops, so essentially alternatives to things like rice and maize and wheat. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit more first about what are the kinds of alternatives that you research?
Let me do that by saying Crops of the Future is the only centre in the world dedicated to these underutilised, sometimes called orphan or neglected crops. And, of course, that's a huge responsibility. We're hosted here in Malaysia, but it's a global mandate. So we have the world mandate to look at underutilised crops. And as you say, they're underutilised because they've fallen largely into disuse or been reduced in terms of their importance because of the dominance of what we call major crops or staple crops. Those are the ones that we depend on so much now for food security.
And when you say food security, what does that actually mean?
Good question, because people understand food security as having enough food to eat. But actually the big issue now is not food security, it's nutrition. It's nutritional security, because the big challenge for us now is to nourish more people on a hotter planet. And for that, these crops actually have a very significant role, because in large measure, these underutilized crops contain very much more nutrition than the major staple crops, which, of course, we depend on for calories and carbohydrates. If I can, and I'd like to set the agenda for listeners, there's 7 billion people on the planet. There's going to be 10 billion people by 2050. So there's 3 billion more mouths to feed, full stop. To do that, we're going to need about 60% more food. And to get 60% more food, we need an area twice the land area of India to produce that extra food, and we haven't got it. So our challenge now is that we're going to have to feed more people with crops that we currently depend on a hotter planet, 3 degrees hotter planet, and we're going to have to be absolutely sure if the top four crops, which we now depend on for more than 60% of our food, are going to be enough. And if they're not, we better look for other crops, because everybody depends on these few crops for most of our food.
Is it really such a large part of food security that we must be able to grow our own crops? Because there is a global supply chain in place. And say, for example, if one country stops exporting a particular crop, the global supply chain will take some time to rebalance. But at the end of the day, there are always other options for people to take. So why is it of such great importance that we must produce our own food?
It wasn't once. I mean, you know, when we hear of things like the Green Revolution, which was a huge success, at its time and in its time, it was the right thing to do, because it had to feed people who were increasingly starving, malnourished. The world has changed. And now those long supply chains, for two reasons. One is that they're vulnerable. You know, long supply chains aren't ones that you can guarantee are going to get to you in time. The other is, of course, long supply chains mean carbon footprint. We're taking food from one place to feed people somewhere else. And the idea was, we'll do that because we can grow something else or produce something else and trade with that. So we can make something, sell it, and then buy food. That's a very risky strategy now. And increasingly, as we get into a more vulnerable political and environmental consequences for the planet, we have to be much more conscious that we can actually secure enough food for ourselves. I'll give you an example. Next door in Singapore, 30 by 30 strategy. And Singapore, you know, it's a tiny country, but it actually is saying we will need to produce 30% of our own food by 2030. And I think it's currently something like 4% now. Now, Singapore wouldn't do that unless it recognized how critical food security is and its own reliance on itself to grow food, because it needs to provide enough for these times of volatility and political instability, which are increasingly going to occur as we get into more difficult environments.
So, Professor, what is your assessment of Malaysia's level of food security? Because we discuss a lot about self-sufficiency levels of rice, for example. Mm-hmm. But there is also the school of thought that says, you know, just looking at rice alone is not enough. So what is your overall assessment here in Malaysia?
Very vulnerable. And the reasons are that we've doubled our import bill in the last 10 years. So I think something like 60 billion ringgit of imports of food. And then you go, so where is what are those big imports, and we're bringing in a lot of food and ingredients that are made into processed foods. Mm-hmm. So 20 billion ringgit or something like that is actually processed ingredients to make foods that we could actually grow ourselves. The second issue is when you mentioned rice security, of course that's perfectly reasonable to say we should be secure in rice, but when we look at the big four crops, rice, wheat, soya, maize, we don't grow the other three. Mm. But we do have, and this is the paradox to me for Malaysia, it is the second richest source of biodiversity on land on the planet. So if you go from Brazil, which is the richest, or the Amazonian region is the richest, Malaysia is second. 1 in 20 plants on the planet comes from Malaysia. Yet we don't look at them. We look at other crops that we bring here because we say, well, of course, our natural biodiversity is not particularly useful. And that, I think, is the game changer. If you really want to look at the comparative advantage Malaysia has, it has two biodiversity advantages on land and in the oceans, because it's the richest source of marine biodiversity in the region. This region is the richest source of marine biodiversity. And as I mentioned, it's the second richest source of terrestrial biodiversity. So we've got the future. We've got the options for us and the solutions for us hiding in plain sight right in front of us. We see these plants, we literally see them, but we're not using them.
And why is that the case? Is it just that we're exposed to perhaps Western influences and cultures, and these ideas of what is an acceptable food do not encompass the biodiversity that we have at our fingertips?
Partly, and I think, you know, what we have to do is rethink agriculture. You have to think differently. You have to think about these plants. For what are you going to grow them for? Are they just for food? Are they for animal feed? We import huge amounts of animal feed to feed aquaculture and poultry. You know, poultry doesn't know it's eating maize meal. Poultry knows it's eating carbohydrates and starch. So here is opportunity, and innovation will drive that opportunity. But you've got to start with what's your natural resource base. And Malaysia is very, very rich in natural resources that we are not taking seriously in terms of opportunities.
Price would also be a factor here, right? Because if we look at our agricultural business, we do tend to be dominated by, for example, oil palm plantations. And CFF, your office, indeed in Semenye, is located practically on the edges of a palm oil plantation. Yeah. And so what is there to incentivize plantation players to shift towards growing more crop-based products? Because at the end of the day, you know, our oil palms, they have a much longer turnover than food crops typically do. Essentially, you get more bang for your buck.
Well, you do, or you did. Of course, there's also a lot of issues about what is the long-term future of palm oil because of the low price and political pressures on it. Palm oil is a wonderful crop because it produces a very high yield on areas that you would need something like 9 times as much to produce vegetable from soya.
Yes.
So no one is in the business of saying palm oil shouldn't be a major part of the economic future of Malaysia. What it hasn't yet addressed is, as Captain Kirk would say, space, the final frontier. Because with 6 million, 5.85 million hectares of land under palm oil, we calculate 1.27 million hectares of space under the oil palm in the electricity pylon corridors across the country. Now, if I tell you 1.27 million hectares is not used in a country where land, of course, is increasingly going to be under pressure, that's a missed opportunity. How much is 1.27 million hectares? It's the land area of the Netherlands. The land area of the Netherlands is going begging in Malaysia, and the Netherlands, excuse me, is the second largest agricultural exporter on the planet. And with respect to the Netherlands, you know, it's a cold part of the world, mostly on or just above sea level. How do they produce more food than any other country apart from the USA on land that we literally aren't taking any serious look at? So diversification of oil palm is opportunity, but for that we need new ideas, we need innovation, so we can actually see how we can integrate diversification into oil palm and actually see that as a business opportunity.
So, Professor, under crops for the future, there are a couple of underutilized crops. For example, I believe you looked at the moringa.
Yeah.
Right, and the Bambara groundnut. And how suitable would these plants, or perhaps some of the others that you've looked into in your research, how scalable would these be?
You start with, would they grow here? Yes, they do grow here. So we're starting with crops. Bambara groundnut kachang poi has been grown in Malaysia. It's an African legume, but it's been grown in Malaysia, Thailand and Indonesia for many hundreds of years on a small scale. As we get into more marginal environments, and we take Kedah, which is one of our flagship projects, the Kedah Action Plan for Agriculture Diversification, what we're doing there is looking at land that's no longer suitable for big crops, and increasingly that land is getting marginal for the rice and the other crops. What could we do on that land? Well, Bambara groundnut becomes a very viable crop. It'll never produce the highest yields on the planet. As we improve it, and better than that, we make value-added products from it. You know, we don't have to grow Bambara groundnut just for its ingredients for food. We can make flavor compounds from it. You know, I mean, these are really interesting, exciting areas that we can actually see as innovation. Moringa, you'll drive past Moringa or you walk past Moringa wherever you go in Malaysia, because it's been grown in the backyard by lots of communities, particularly the Indian community, for many hundreds of years. But it's now almost semi-wild. You look at the leaves. Very high in protein, very nutritious. We can make into products which are actually highly marketable, highly nutritious, and locally sourced. And that's a combination you don't often get. Now, your question's right. How do you scale?
Mm-hmm.
And CFF is a research center. And one of our challenges is to bring private sector to see the opportunities and to invest and to see how they can take what we call prototypes or proof of concept to market. And that's really our big challenge now, is to bring the private sector into the company. We can't become a commercial centre to sell these products, because that's not our strength. Well, the private sector is good at that.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they can see that we can be their research partner, produce something which they can take to scale, opportunities now are really waiting to be taken advantage of.
And we'll get into the challenges facing CFF and as well as the private sector's uptake in just a little while. I'm speaking with Professor Syed Azam Ali, CEO of Crops for the Future, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Professor Syed Azam Ali, CEO of Crops for the Future, a research centre looking at underutilised crops. So, Professor, earlier you mentioned one of the challenges that CFF faces is getting the private sector to be the commercial partner to your research. What kind of a response have you seen from the private sector thus far, and what other challenges might you be facing?
There's a lot of interest in the private sector, but the private sector wants to see something working before it invests in it, and we're there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, underpinning all of that is who's going to take the risk? Because you're asking farmers to go and grow a crop they're not familiar with, and you're asking the private sector to take it to market, and they may say, well, you know, where's the market? So we have the global knowledge base. And if you take the FAO, it doesn't collect all the data on the minor crops and make it available.
Mm-hmm.
We've done that. So we've got a global knowledge base on all of these alternative crops. Not to sit in a database somewhere in Seminier, but to be usable for end users, for stakeholders. We will give you all of this data, all of this knowledge to support the decisions that you need to make in terms of growing crops, the suitability, the return on investment, the market, the potential demand, scalability. Now I think the private sector should say, great, you know, you are backing us to make these decisions. And if I describe CFF as a very small organization, 50 staff, we're basically an Uber.
I see.
Because what we do is leverage on talent and facilities, expertise and resources around the world and build on that so that we can fast track applications for underutilized crops, not from scratch, not reinventing the wheel, but taking our crops and using information and knowledge that's already there that we can apply to these crops.
And essentially, you'd also be kind of a disruptor to a traditional agriculture businesses. So I can see where the Uber analogy might be interesting.
Well, we are disruptive, and we have to be. And
yeah.
If you take Wiebe Yobien, who's the Minister of Mestec, of course, she's talking about leadership. Here is an opportunity. The big advantage Malaysia has is you already have a crops for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And if we talk about leadership in the whole issue of sustainable development and climate change, this is the opportunity to not be a follower. And often people say to me, well, we're too small for innovation. You know, countries like Malaysia should be taking technology off the shelf. Nonsense. You know, we should be looking at innovation that's self-produced, that we can actually take a leadership role, not just in Malaysia, but in the ASEAN region and globally. If you go to other parts of the world, they would never have that opportunity. And if you take a country like Denmark, Denmark has got 13% of the land area of Malaysia, and it produces enough food for 30 million people, which is the population of Malaysia.
And it produces excess as well, because it exports, I think 20% of their total exports is made up of food produce.
And if you take that as a developed country, mm-hmm. and often people say, oh, agriculture, sunset industry. Again, that's wrong. Agriculture is at the center of the future, not just because it's an economic driver, but it's a necessity. If I tell you, you're going to have to use agriculture three times a day because you eat three times a day, that is not a sunset mm-hmm. industry. That's an opportunity industry.
Yes, but just going back to something you said a little bit earlier, Professor, when you were talking about inducing the private sector to take the risk and to really pick up on the research that CFF is doing, you mentioned that you have to show them where the market is. So where is the market? Because, you know, as we know, business and society, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation when it comes to introducing new products like this. If they don't see that there would be enough demand amongst the general public for them to essentially make money off the product, then what's there to convince them to take it up?
Well, you know, people think, oh, it's agriculture, crops for the future. No, it isn't. It's the whole value chain, and it takes us right into political and mm-hmm. social and cultural and ethical issues of how we actually address the future. Now, you're right, the private sector is going to say, well, why should we take up these crops? The political sector has to sit down and say, what is the price of not doing that? Mm-hmm. And I'll give you the example again. Malaysia has got 38% overweight population. It's got 13% obesity. That means half the population is either overweight or obese. Who pays the bill? The government. Because, of course, these are hospital admissions for obesity, diabetes, hypertension, all caused by bad diets, because mm-hmm. bad diets are killing us. The other point, which is really critical, is there's a phenomenon called hidden hunger. Now, you know, it may sound an odd thing to say hidden hunger.
Okay.
What we have are populations now, urban populations, you know, cities and populations like the Klang Valley, in which we have apparently well-fed people, particularly children, who are actually micronutrient deficient.
Hmm.
And we are now seeing more stunting in Malaysia than we're seeing in Ghana. And it's the same level of stunting as it was 20 years ago. And you can't unstunt a child. And that's all caused by micronutrient deficiencies in the food that they're now eating. And where we got the micronutrients from? The moringas, the bambaras, all the crops we're looking at.
And of course, the government will be continuing to pay the bill, so to speak, on, for example, stunted children as they grow into adulthood, because they are the future of the labour market. But at the same time, Professor, what has been the reception from the government been like towards your research? Because it feels like there might be some conflict, particularly when you've got protectionist policies for rice growers here in Malaysia. How do you see this being balanced when it comes to the government's response to CFF?
Well, funnily enough, the Prime Minister called me into his office on the 22nd of May last year, you know, 13 days after an election. He called me in again in December last year, and he said, what are you going to do about rice in Kedah? What are you going to do about rice farmers? They're getting poorer, they're getting older, which is true, and they're getting angrier. And I said, it's not for us to increase the yield of rice. There's lots of institutions working on that, and their responsibility is to increase the yield of rice, and so they should. What about the space that's in rice paddies? What about the alternatives and additional crops we can produce that produce high-value products to supplement rice? And then he said, what are you going to do about the oil palm sector? Which is why, you know, those numbers were I quoted earlier. Again, I said, my job is not to increase the yield of oil palm. That's the huge industry in the oil palm sector looking at, and the whole academic community looking at oil palm yield. But the space we have can actually generate income for smallholders who are very vulnerable, as you know, to the global price of oil palm. Now, what the Prime Minister has done, which is absolutely the right strategy, is to seek diversification, but actually to integrate that. In other words, to say we're going to use the successful model of plantations, not for more monocultures of other cash crops, but to actually integrate mosaics so that we can actually grow crops under a controlled system. In other words, you know, not smallholders just growing their own piece of little piece of land, because that's not going to be economic. How do we integrate all of that into schemes in which smallholders are actually part of an integrated, diverse, techie, innovative-driven production system in which we actually bring the best and the brightest?
Mm-hmm.
Because without that, we're just back to, we've got to have rice security and we've got oil palm.
Have you been able to engage with the government since meeting with the Prime Minister?
We do, and particularly we're talking with the Northern Corridor Implementation Authority, and that's something which is very exciting because NCIA is, and the phrase they use was, failure is not an option. We have to deliver, and we have to deliver in the northern states. Why? Because for lots of reasons, but one of them is these are the most vulnerable states economically and politically and, of course, environmentally. Those are the front lines for climate change. And if there's one thing that CFF is actually responsible for, it's finding solutions that are climate resilient, which is why we're under MESTEC, not MOA, because, you know, you take the title, environment, science, technology, energy, climate change. I mean, all those things are under the CFF mandate, underpinned by science, technology, innovation, STI.
So, Professor, you've been working in the food security business, in fact, looking at these underutilized crops for 30 years. How have you seen attitudes towards food security change over the years, particularly here in Malaysia over the last few years?
I've seen it elsewhere faster. And, of course, we see, you know, the whole issue now of plant-based protein and replacing animal protein. Of course, the people eating these burgers are not vegetarians. These are meat eaters who are now eating protein from pea and soya. Why pea and soya? Why can't we use Bambara grana? Why can't we use other legumes we could grow here instead of importing pea and soya protein to replace meat? That technology is right at the beginning. Huge opportunities in new tech, new food, new products. And the food sector is worried because if you look at the agri-food sector, they have single products or they have single supply chains. And they're now saying that consumers are demanding healthier. I mean, take the example of snacks, and people are saying, we want healthier, locally sourced, nutritious snacks. What can you give us? And the food sector hasn't got them. And that's really where the opportunities are. Now, you're right, there's a price point and there's an economics to this, but that is actually incentivizing nutrition. It's, you know, when we talked previously about the Green Revolution, we said yield for profit. We talked about a yield for profit paradigm. And, of course, farmers have to make profit. We're now talking about a yield for nutrition paradigm, but it's got to be profitable. And how do you make it profitable? You increase demand, you increase interest, and you actually provide policies that encourage nutrition because, as I say before, the country and particularly the population suffer if we don't help provide nourishment.
And do you see the Malaysian population also continuing this shift towards more locally produced, more sustainable foods?
Definitely. And I go to restaurants. I mean, of course, you're going to say, well, they're high-end restaurants. I mean, of course, we go there because they're locally sourcing ingredients. You know, we were in Beta Kale last week. We go to Duakan and they go, it's very expensive. But actually, we can make those foods because they're locally sourced into foods that everybody else will have access to. The difference is the mindset. We're back to mindset because we're literally addicted to fast foods. I mean, I think something like 44% of foods eaten in the Klang Valley are out of a fast food outlet. And the other reason is I think we've got to look at availability. And that is another big issue. Accessibility, availability, affordability. If we can't make those things happen, we can't actually increase diversity. But that comes from a mindset of wanting better diets and better nutrition and political support to actually achieve that.
Thank you so much for your time, Professor. I've been speaking with Professor Syed Azam Ali, CEO of Crops for the Future. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with faster speeds every day. Baru la bes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.